Okay, let's pick up where we left off in the book of Hosea. We left off in chapter 2. And for those of you who weren't here last week, just real briefly, you know, Hosea was a prophet of God. He lived around 755 to 717 B.C. Okay, he prophesied around that particular area of time. But he was a very, very unique prophet in the sense that he was a contemporary of Amos. We just went through the book of Amos not too long ago. And Amos was, you know, a prophet who preached hellfire and brimstone and the destruction of, you know, God's people because of their wickedness and their idolatry and their waywardness and their immorality, so on and so forth. And so Amos really brought forth God's justice in very, you know, black and white colors. But Hosea was turned around and used about the same time to show a different side of God's character, that he still was a God of justice. He still was going to punish his people. He still was going to discipline them, chastise them for their wickedness. But he wanted to convey to them his love for them. And he conveyed it in such a way that, you know, when God created Adam and Eve, made them male and female, they were created in his image and likeness. And the husband and wife bond represented spiritually God's love for his people and vice versa. Anyway, Hosea was called by God to go find himself a harlot, a prostitute, a whore, and take her as his wife, and then to bear children by her. And the children that she did bear him that were given very prophetic names, like she had a son named Jezreel, meaning God sows, and God was going to punish the house of Israel because of the sins of Jeru, who way overstepped his bounds as far as God's judgment in the valley of Jezreel. But then he had another a daughter by the name of Lo Ruhamah, which meant no more mercy, no more compassion, that God was no longer going to have compassion on his people. And then she had another son, and they named him Lo Amai, which means not my people. Okay, God, it was a very unique thing because, like I said last week, if you can put it in this proper context, if you name a child a particular name, and it's really got a strange name, like if you would raise up a child and you were named the child utter destruction, well, first of all, people probably throw you in jail for child abuse, but you see, that name would stick out, and it would raise a lot of questions, and people want to know, why did you name your kid that? And of course, the kid would be wondering that too. Why did you name me that? But he would be a living testimony, a living prophecy to show that God was going to destroy, you know, their people who were wickedness. And God also did that with Isaiah. You know, if you read in Isaiah chapter 8, he had a son. He named him Mehir-Shalah-Hazbaz. I would like a name like that. And that was to mean speedy is the spoil and quick as the prey, meaning that God was going to bring judgment speedily upon rebellious people. But God sometimes used particular names to convey a very strong message. Anyway, the important part of this to remember is that Hosea went out and he selected a wife, and she was a whore, she was a prostitute. But it's my contention that he really, really loved her. He really had a heart for this woman. Because I can't believe for one minute that he would feel nothing for her. He would just be doing it totally out of obedience to God, and this is the biggest drag in the world. No, he went out there and he selected a woman who was a harlot, and he took her as his wife. And it was supposed to be a symbolism of the way God had taken Israel to be his wife, and then how his wife continued to be unfaithful to Hosea, just like Israel was unfaithful to God, and how it broke God's heart, just like it would break Hosea's heart. So just keep that in mind when we start reading this chapter 2 and 3. And it says here in chapter 2, "Say to your brothers Amai and to your sister Ruhamah, contend with your mother, contend, for she is not my wife when I am not her husband. And let her put away her harlotry from her face and her adultery from between her breasts." Now, here's the thing. When we read in chapter 1, it wasn't Amai, it was Lo Amai. We read in chapter 1, it wasn't Ruhamah, it was Lo Ruhamah. In other words, Lo means no. So it's, in other words, now he's dropped the Lo. And so it's a real play on words here. So when he says, "Say to your brothers Amai and to your sister Ruhamah, contend with your mother, contend." Well, it's very symbolic if you look at it. because he's using Amai, which means my people, and Rehuama means mercy. And he's saying, contend with your mother. Now, their literal mother, of course, was Gomer, Hosea's wife, the harlot. But the symbolic mother was Israel. Okay? And Amai and Rehuama were, you know, the descendants of Israel, the children of Israel, who God had mercy upon, who God had called to, as his people. And take this one step further. The reason he doesn't call them Lo Amai and Lo Rehuama here is, I think, because look at the context. Say to your brothers Amai and to your sister Rehuama, contend with your mother, contend, for she is not my wife. So what he's saying is, my true people, contend with those who claim to be my people. In other words, one of the most frustrating things is for when you see true committed Christians for Christ taking a stand for morality, and in their stand for morality, they say, hey, homosexuality is wrong, abortion is wrong, fornication is wrong, premarital sex is wrong, extramarital sex is wrong. You know, all of these things are wrong, okay? And yet you'll see a number of people claiming to be Christian who will argue the other side, that abortion is okay. And so there's a contention here. You've got people who claim to be Christian. You've got a nation here that claims to be Christian. But we have to contend with it, don't we? We have to fight with it and say, hey, we're not a real Christian nation. Look at what we're doing. How can we possibly be a Christian nation? And when you stand up and say that, you are labeled as being fanatical or extremist or intolerant or bigoted or, you know, uncompassionate. See what I'm saying? So nothing's changed. Thousands of years have come and gone, and nothing's changed because human nature hasn't changed. Okay, say it to your brothers, Amai, and to your sister, Rehuama, contend with your mother, contend, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. Now, you know, that would just make these people red-faced with indignation because they say, hey, we are God's people. Mm-hmm. You see, but who did Jesus Christ have to contend with most when he walked the face of the earth? It was the religious leaders. It was the Sadducees. It was the Pharisees. It was the very people who staunchly claimed to be God's people. And when Christ came along and said, hey, your father's the devil, man, they were ready to stone him in a heartbeat. But see, that's what happens when true, committed people of God confront people who are just religious or hold to a veneer of being religious or God's people. But their hearts are far from them. It's a constant warfare, isn't it? It's a constant contention. And man, it can get really heated and it can be really ugly. It says, and let her put away her harlotry from her face and her adultery from between her breasts. Now, this is kind of interesting. Put away her harlotry from her face. In other words, it's written all over her what she is. She's a harlot. All right? Well, for America, all we have to do is just look at America and look at what we do to prostitute God's word or his commitment. I mean, look at the filth that comes out of the TV and out of our entertainment industry. It's almost as though if we are really going to be serious with God, we got to do away with this stuff. The pornography and all this stuff. We got to get away with it. So that's what it's saying here. Put away her harlotry from her face. If you're talking to America, put away all of this filth and this garbage, all this false religions and all these cults. Put it away because it's so obvious. People just look at it. You know what I'm saying? And see what you stand for. And this is her adultery from between her breasts. In other words, what's closest to her heart? Jesus says, where your treasure lies, so lies your heart, right? And again, you have to get back to basics. What's the most important thing in your life? You know, is it your kids, is it your house, your spouse, whatever. You got to put God first because that's what he's dealing with here. Things that are very, very obvious and things that you don't see. Things that are, you know, it says, put away your harlotry from her face and adultery from between her breasts. In other words, the things that are obvious, put us at enmity with God, and things that aren't so obvious, things that are in the heart, it's just between you and God, or God's the only one who knows. It boils down to this, right? Jesus said, where your treasure lies, so lies your heart. What's the most important thing in your life? If it's not God, then what it's saying here is that it's adultery. And then it says in verse 3, it says, lest I strip her naked and expose her on a day when she was born, and I will also make her like a wilderness, make her like desert land, and slay her with thirst. It's saying that God's making this threat. Unless you change, I will strip you naked, and I'll expose you as the day when you're born. Well, this is what's going to happen to America. To be exposed on the day as on the day that you were born means that you are totally vulnerable. You are totally, you know, at others' mercy. You are totally helpless. And this nation is just arrogant and thinks that, well, we are superpower. We're the only superpower in the world now. And, you know, we have so much, you know, confidence or, you know, self-assurance in our own ability. Hey, God showed us on 9/11 how easy it is to attack this country. And he says, I will strip her naked and expose her on a day as on the day when she was born. He said this of Israel, you know, 700 years before Christ. And it had its fulfillment when the Assyrians came down and just overran them. And it has an application for us today, that if we don't turn around from our wicked ways and our spiritual harlotries, that this is going to happen to us too. He says, I will also make her like a wilderness and make her like a desert land. In other words, barren, unfruitful, empty. I mean, this is what's happening in this country in so many ways. And it says here in that verse 4, it says, also I will have no compassion on her children because they are children of harlotry. For her mother has played a harlot. She who conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, I would go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water and my wool, my flax and my oil and my drink. Now, he says he's going to not have compassion on her children. Well, understand something. When God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, when God destroyed the world by the flood, little children were drowned in the flood, and little children was incinerated in the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah. Little children and infants, their souls were not lost. I'm convinced of that because of their innocence. However, because of their parents' sin, these kids came under judgment, just like when Adam and Eve sinned. We're all under this judgment because of them. Well, and the same thing is going to hold true during the tribulation period. When God takes his church out of the world, this world is still going to be flooded and gutted with little children. Why? Because children are not going to be sanctified unless they have a believing parent. Unless they have a parent that is committed to God, you know, the children are going to stay here. So it's not like God doesn't have compassion upon children, but it's the parents' fault that brings this judgment upon the kids themselves. And then look why. It says in that verse 5, for her mother has played the harlot. She who conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water and my wool and my flax and my oil and my drink. Now, in other words, Israel got involved in a mixture of religion. They mixed the one true religion with all the pagan religions of the Canaanites. And they began to worship the god called Baal. And they figured that Baal was the one that provided them with fertile fields and the fertile grass and fertile cattle. And that Baal was the one who did all of this. So they would offer incense and sacrifice to Baal along with God. But Baal was given the credit for what? Their abundant crops in their fields. It says here that they said that he gives my bread and my water. In other words, their basic necessities, as well as wool and flax, which is clothing for winter and for summer, and oil and my drink. In other words, my luxuries, these type of things. Well, look at today. Things haven't changed that much. If you look at the situation today, who gives God credit for the things that we enjoy in life? Look at how he's blessed this nation. I mean, he's blessed this nation abundantly, just incredibly. We have been blessed with such incredible resources and wealth and material things, and he's prospered us in every way. And look what this nation has done. Not only have we kicked them out of our schools and all these other places, but they are ramming down our children's throats this whole phony, cockamamie BS about evolution, yeah. Right? Yeah. And for Christians to come in and say, hey, at least allow us to teach creationism alongside it so that they can see for themselves what makes perfect common sense when you show all the facts. Evolution is just a bunch of theories and hypotheses, and they teach it like it's scientific fact. And all I'm saying is this. If I truly believed in evolution, if I was a professor, if I was a teacher, if I was pushing this, if I believed this with all my heart, I'd say, yeah, bring it on, bring it on. Wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I'll turn your whole concept of creationism and I'll twist it into a pretzel. I'll make you look like a complete fool. Bring it over here. But they don't dare do it because they are not dealing with truth. Isn't that something? They will not allow a different point of view because they know that they aren't teaching the truth, but they do everything to rob God of his glory, of his honor, of the thanks, the appreciation of that he deserves. Mm-hmm. Just like here. What do? They turn around and they do what? Okay. They give Baal, they give these other entities the credit for what God does. Mm-hmm. See what I'm saying? And it says in verse 6, therefore, behold, I will hedge up her way with thorns, and I will build a wall against her, so she cannot find her path. And she will pursue her lovers, but she will not overtake them. And she will seek them, but she will not find them. And then she will say, I will go back to my first husband, for it was better for me than now. Now, how many times does this happen in people's lives individually? In other words, they forsake God. Maybe they grew up in the church. Maybe they have a pretty solid foundation as far as their knowledge of God. But they forsake God because they want something else in life. And so what does God do sometimes? He hedges up their way where they can't, where they get frustrated. They can't achieve what they want to achieve. And they end up, you know, making a mess out of their lives because of a lot of stupid, idiotic choices or bad choices or whatever. And then finally, when they come to the end of their rope, so to speak, then they say, man, like the prodigal son who's wallowing with the pigs and eating, you know, their food or longing to eat their food. He comes to the sense that, hey, man, even the servants in my father's house had it better off than me. What am I doing? So he goes back to his father. How many times have people have done this with Christ? Well, God's not proud. He'll stoop to conquer, and he'll take us as long, even if we've shown, hey, we prefer everything else to him. But if we get our way hedged up to the point where we just get so frustrated and we make such a mess of our lives, then we turn back to him. You know, I used to be in prison ministries. I've been in and out of prisons many, many times. And I tell you right now, a lot of these convicts in there that, you know, that I've talked to, when they are in prison, when they've really come to the end of the rope, then they've got to get serious about God. Unfortunately, a lot of them, when they get out, you know, they go right back to their old ways. But their way is hedged up. In other words, you know, so that puts them in a situation where at least a number of them will consider giving their life to Christ. Otherwise, they want nothing to do with them. But that's what God did to Israel as a nation, is that he hedged up her ways in such a way that her so-called lovers, which were these other nations and these other gods and all these other things that they would look to for their sustenance or look to for their security or whatever, rather than looking to God, well, they'd turn on them and these people would finally come to their senses. Well, you know, that's what God has to do, and that's what I think he's going to have to do to this nation before we finally come to our senses. Read that last part again where it says here, and she will pursue her lovers, but she will not overtake them, and she will seek them, but not find them. Then she will say, I will go back to my first husband, for it was better for me than now. That's what it's going to come to in this country. When things really, really get bad, this country was finally going to wake up and they're going to say, hey, man, I want to go back to my first husband. I want to go back to God. Because it was a lot better for me then than it is now. Well, right, it's not going to happen right now. We have to really get hit hard with some pretty hard judgment before people will finally wake up and say, hey, as a nation, we need to return to God. You see what I'm saying? And then he says in verse 8, he says, for she does not know that it was I who gave her the grain and the new wine and the oil and lavished her on her the silver and the gold which they used for Baal. It's like this nation. I mean, what's that song, God Bless America? You know, he shed his grace on thee. And everything that he's given this nation as far as a bounty, as far as the resources, the freedoms, everything. We've become a nation of just ungrateful pigs. And that's putting it mildly. When you look at how people just do not give God the credit, the glory, the worship, the thanks. Instead, they attribute all of our blessings to some other thing rather than God. Just like I did there, it says in verse 8, for she does not know that it is I who gave her the grain, the new wine, and the oil. Well, we once knew that and lavished her on her silver and gold. We are the wealthiest nation on earth, right? Which they use for the Baals. In other words, they use for Baal worship. We're taking so much of our money and our materials and doing what with? We blaspheme God with it. We insult God with it. With so much of the wealth that he's given us. And then he says here in verse 9, he says, therefore I will take back my grain at harvest time and my new wine in a season. I will also take away my wool and my flax and give it to cover her nakedness. And then I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and no one will rescue her out of my hand. So this is the judgment that we're going to bring upon ourselves because of our ungratefulness. Is that God has blessed us so much abundantly, you know, materially, right? Prospered us so much as far as wealth. I mean, even the poorest of our poor in this nation are rich comparison to some of the poorest of the rest of the world. There's no doubt about it, right? Well, God's saying, hey, I've made you a very, very, I've prospered you as a nation. You've been blessed with incredible wealth and material prosperity beyond anybody's wildest imagination. And this is what I get for it? Well, I'm going to take this away from you. We see it all being taken away from us little by little, and it's kind of like just eroding right before our eyes. But, you know, it's going to happen in a big way. Real big way in the near future. Then in verse 11, he says, I will also put an end to all her gaiety and her feasts and her new moons and her Sabbaths and all of her festival assemblies, and I will destroy her vines and her fig trees, of which she said, these are my wages, which my lovers have given me, and I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field will devour them, and I will punish her for the days of the Baal, when she used to offer sacrifices to them and adore herself with her earrings and jewelry, and follow her lovers so that she forgot me, declares the Lord. So basically, that's what God's going to have to do to this nation. The very things that made us such a great nation in terms of our wealth and our prosperity and our material things that God has blessed us with, we have not shown the appreciation and thanks to God for these things, so he's going to have to take it away from us, just like he did with Israel. And he's going to punish us severely. And that he had to discipline them, chastise them, bring them behind the woodshed and beat them within an inch of their life before they get some sense knocked into them. And I think that this is what's going to happen in this nation. You know, it's inevitable. God's not going to just allow us to keep going the way we're going. I mean, if he loves us, he's going to do something, and he's already doing it. But most people they're not waking up to this reality because it's not bad enough for them yet. And then it says here in verse 14, it says, therefore, behold, I will lure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak kindly to her. Then I will give her vineyards from there and the valley of Achor as a door of hope. And she will sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the days when she came up from the land of Egypt. And it will come about in that day, declares the Lord, that you will call me Ishi and will no longer call me Baali. For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth so that they will be mentioned by their names no more. And okay, back up to that verse 14. He says, therefore, this is the third therefore he's using because of her waywardness. He says, I will lure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak kindly to her. Well, what's God going to have to do with his people? Bring her to a place of destitution, the wilderness. Bring her to a place where all of these distractions and all these things that have averted their affections, he's going to take away from her and bring her to into the wilderness. And what did Jesus say in one of the Beatitudes? Blessed are those who mourn. Why? For they shall be comforted. Let's face it. You know that old saying that goes, I walked a mile with laughter, she chattered all away, but left me none the wiser for all she had to say. I walked a mile with sorrow, and narrow words said she, but all the things I learned from her when sorrow walked with me. I mean, you know, you don't learn a lot when you're at a party and you're whooping it up, laughing and carrying on. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm just simply saying, well, if that's basically your life, your highlight of your life, well, it shows that something's drastically wrong. And so God will very often put us through a dark night of the soul, or put us through some very, very difficult times to deepen us as people. I walked a mile with sorrow, and narrow words said she, but all the things I learned from her when sorrow walked with me. Well, this is what happens when your whole world is turned upside down, and then you turn to God. You're in this wilderness, and you turn to God with all your heart. Well, God will comfort you, and he will speak kindly to you in this situation, but it's still a disciplined situation. Just like when they were going through the wilderness, when God first brought them out of Egypt. Well, unfortunately, they didn't go into the promised land, so they spent 40 years wandering around in the wilderness as a judgment from God, and it was a discipline from God. God spoke kindly to them there in many respects, but at the same time, they were under his judgment. They were under his discipline because of their disobedience. And this is how he basically works with people, individuals, and also as nations, is that if we forget God long enough and forsake him long enough and blaspheme him or insult him long enough, you know, he's going to really lower the boom, but out of his mercy, a lot of times he will, you know, keep a remnant, but they will still be under discipline, still be under chastisement. And then he says here in verse 15, then I will give her vineyards from there and the valley of Achor as a door of hope. Anybody remember what the valley of Achor stands for?
It's where the son of Achan.
Good. Happened. Well, what happened there was when they first went into the promised land, and the first city that they attacked was Jericho. And remember, they walked around Jericho seven times after 7 days, and the whole walls, no, and the walls fell down. Okay, I'm getting there. And the walls fell down. Well, God gave a specific command that everything, all the gold and the silver and all the cattle, everything was to be under the ban. Everything was to be dedicated to God. It was belonged to God. In other words, it was to be given to God for his temple, for you know, the tabernacle, and it's given to the priest, a way of giving it to God. Well, Achan goes in there. He sees a gold bar and some purple cloth and some other stuff. He grabs it, stuffs it into his tunic or whatever, and takes it home. And then it says he took it to his tent, dug a hole. So obviously his family knew about it and hid it in the tent. But then the next city they were to attack was Ai. And so Joshua said, well, this is going to be a pushover. There's nothing like Jericho because it's just a small city. So he just sent a small division of men up there, and they got this knot kicked out of them, and 30-something men got killed. And Joshua, you know, throws himself on the ground and is before the God all day long, just saying, oh, Lord, what's going to happen to us now? You know, the rest of the nations find us out. We've had it. We're finished. We're through. And Joshua was on his face all day pleading with God, and then finally God, at evening, God said, hey, get up off your face. He says, there's sin in the camp. You got to deal with it. And so God, what God did is he had all the tribes pass before God, and then he selected a tribe, and he had all the clans pass before God. He selected a clan, and he had all the families, and then he finally narrowed it down to the individual in Achan. The lot was cast for Achan. And then Joshua said, hey, man, you give glory to God. What did you do? And Achan said, well, you know, I took this gold bar, and I took this, and then Joshua said, man, you have really brought some trouble on us. So God said, take him down to the valley of Achor and stone him there, him and his family.
Wow.
So he's taken down to the valley of Achor, and they were stoned to death there because of the disobedience. That's how they got rid of the sin. Well, the valley of Achor represents a judgment. If you read this here, it says, then I will give her vineyards from there and the valley of Achor as a door of hope. In other words, when all seems hopeless for them, it's this very judgment that they are under, this very punishment that they are under, is going to be their hope. That it's going to turn them around. And I think that's what's going to happen in this country, that our only hope is to really be chastised severely enough where it really wakes people up. I mean, when 9/11 happened, there was a little bit of a heartbeat spiritually. You know, the attendance of church went up a little bit, right? And people were saying, God bless America, and people were really talking about God. But, you know, what? Or 9 months later, it's like, church attending, why bite back down? Everything. We're just brain dead again, you know, same old thing. Well, it's going to have to be really severe where this valley of Achor will be turned into what? A door of hope. And it says, she will sing there as in the days of her youth. In other words, she will really have a heart for God, worship God. She will sing there as in the days of her youth. In other words, she will look to God as her first love. And usually that's when people connect with God, is when everything's going along satisfactory with themselves. They can't be bothered with God, or they just worship God from their lips and not from their heart. But when you're really under a lot of stress and a lot of strain and a lot of difficulties and a lot of troubles and tribulation, that, you know, you seek God in a whole different way. And, you know, you cling to Him because you realize you've got nowhere to go but down on your knees, nowhere to look but up. And you take Him serious. And your worship is serious. And your prayers are serious, and you are real serious with God. Well, this is what it's saying here. She will sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the days when she came up from the land of Egypt. You know, she will really be grateful to God, or thankful to God, or worshiping God. And then it says in verse 16, it will come about in that day, declares the Lord, that you will call me Ishai, and you'll no longer call me Baalai. It says it will come about in that day. That day is mentioned, you know, over and over and over and over again throughout Scriptures. And it always refers to the day of the Lord, or when Christ sets up His kingdom, or the end of the world, or that portion of time. So when it talks about that day, it's talking about when Christ comes back, sets up His millennial kingdom. It says here that you will call me Ishai, which means my husband. They will finally look to Jesus Christ as being their God. Okay? The one that they crucified. They rejected their Messiah. And you will no longer call me Baalai. In other words, Baalai means my master. It says they will no longer call me Baalai. It doesn't say you will no longer call on the Baals. You will no longer call me Baalai. In other words, like I said, what happened is that they perverted the one true worship of God, and they inculcated in it a lot of pagan rituals and beliefs and everything else, to the point where it was so perverted that they were calling the one true God these other things. Just like what Paul says in Corinthians. He says, you know, man, I've taught you guys, you know, the truth from day one, and another person comes along and preaches another Jesus, and you accept this greatly. How many people in this country today have a different Jesus than the Jesus of the Scripture. Mm-hmm. See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. They worship a different Jesus. It's not the Scripture of the Bible. Mm-hmm. Not the Jesus of the Bible, rather. Mm-hmm. It's a totally different Jesus. Okay? It's the gimme Jesus. It's the Santa Claus Jesus. It's the butler Jesus. It's the sensual Jesus. It's the academic Jesus. It's, you know, the egghead Jesus. See what I'm saying? And all these cultic Jesus. But it's not the one true Jesus. It's just like with the Baali, meaning my master. In other words, they took the one true religion and they perverted it to the point where the whole thing was just so convoluted you could hardly tell the true from the false. It got so bad. Then it says in verse 17, "For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth so that they will be mentioned by her name, or their names no more." And that's going to happen during the millennial period. And in verse 18, "In that day I will also make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky and the creeping things of the ground, and I will abolish the bow and the sword and war from the land, and I will make them lie down in safety. I will be..." Okay, now look what he says here in that verse 18. This has got to be the millennial period. There's no other period of time it can be. Now just stop and think for a minute. Look what I'm saying here. All you guys that are sleeping. It says here, "In that day I will also make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field," right? "The birds of the sky, the creeping things of the ground, and I will also abolish the bow and the sword and war from the land, and I will make them lie down in safety." Now, if you look at Isaiah 65, don't even turn there, but let me just read what he says here. This is what he describes as the millennial period. He says, "Before, behold, I will create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come to mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in what I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem for rejoicing and her people for gladness. I will also rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people, and there will be no longer be heard in her the voice of weeping and the sound of crying. No longer will there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his days. For the youth will die at an age of 100, and the one who does not reach an age of 100 shall be thought accursed. And they shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall also plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For as the lifetime of a tree, so shall be the days of my people, and my chosen ones shall wear out the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity, for they are the offsprings of those blessed by the Lord and their descendants with them." Now listen to this. "In that day I will also make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky and the creeping things of the ground, and I will abolish the bow." And so well, it says that this is what's going to happen in the millennial period. "It will also come to pass that, behold, before they call, I will answer, and while they are still speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall graze together, and the lion shall eat straw like an ox, and the dust shall be the serpent's food. They shall do no evil or harm on all of my holy mountain, says the Lord." So during the millennial period, this is the covenant he's talking about. Well, during that millennial reign, the lion is going to eat straw like an ox. The wolf, which is the sworn enemy of the sheep or the lamb, is going to lie down with it. You know, take a nap with it. Snuggle up with it. Okay? The serpent, a child can play in a serpent's den and never have any fear of being bitten. Mm-hmm. You see, God is going to make a covenant with all of the creatures that it's going to revert back to the way it was under Adam and Eve, mm-hmm. as far as the animals are concerned. I mean, even today, how many dogs in this country alone tear up little children, you know, kill them, stuff like this? Well, you're not going to see anything like that happen during the millennial period, right? Because why? It says, "In that day I will also make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky and the creeping things on the ground, and I will abolish the bow." In other words, going to do away with war. And so obviously this is future date. Obviously it's going to have its ultimate fulfillment, you know, when Christ returns. Then it says in verse 19, I will betroth you to me forever. Yes, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice and loving kindness and in compassion. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness. Then you will know the Lord." So it's going to be a day when they're going to recognize Jesus Christ as being their Lord, Master, Savior, right? And it's going to be, they're going to be faithful and true and committed to Him. They're no longer going to follow after false gods or false religions and so on and so forth. That's the millennial period. Then he says in verse 21, "And it will come about in that day that I will respond, declares the Lord. I will respond to the heavens, and they will respond to the earth. And the earth will respond to the grain and the new wine and to the oil. And they will respond to Jezreel. And I will sow her for myself in the land, and I will also have compassion on her who had not obtained compassion. And I will say to those who are not my people, you are my people, and they will say, thou art my God. So that's what's going to happen when Christ comes back, sets up the millennial kingdom. Aren't the prophets so right on? In other words, what I'm saying is, we read prophet after prophet after prophet after prophet. It's the same old theme, isn't it? When you can see judgment, 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 but then there's coming a glorious day when God's going to turn all this around, right? I mean, I don't know how many times we've gone through this when just the minor prophets alone, let alone the major prophets, are the same thing. We're reading in Isaiah here how things are really going to get bad for these people, but then in the end, he turns it all around. The day of the Lord, that Christ is going to set up his kingdom, it'll be a glorious day, a day when people will finally be a day of peace and tranquility. There won't be any of what we have to deal with in this day. You know, like he's saying in that verse 21, and it will come about in that day that I will respond, declares the Lord. I will respond to the heavens will respond to the earth will respond to the grain and new wine and new oil. In other words, in that day, God's going to bring such blessing that people, there won't be anything, any such thing as hunger or starvation, because there'll be such abundance crops. Okay, there'll be bumper crops. And it'll be to such an extent, the prophets say, that you won't even finish reaping your one harvest before another one is sown and starts growing. But remember what happened. That's the way it was before the fall, before Adam and Eve sinned. And then when they sinned, God cursed the ground. He says, in the sweat of your brow you shall eat bread. But then, not only that, but then Cain come along, killed Abel. And then God says, Abel's blood is crying to me up from the ground. So the ground was cursed again. So how much has this ground been cursed with all the thousands and millions and hundreds of millions of murders that have happened since Adam and Eve to today? It's going on today. But in that day, prosperity will be the norm for everybody. And then he concludes, he says, and I will say to those who are not my people, which is, he's basically talking to Israel, you are my people. Because remember, he named them Lo Ami, which means not my people. So in that day, he's going to say, they are going to be his people. And it says, and they will say, thou art my God. They will recognize Jesus Christ as being their Lord, Master, and Savior and God. Anybody have any questions? Okay, listen. There's only 5 verses in this chapter 3. Let's just quickly go through that because we can get through it in no time. In verse 1 of chapter 3, it says, then the Lord said to me, go again and love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress. And even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes, so I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. And then I said to her, you shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. So I will also be towards you. For the sons of Israel will remain for many days without a king or a prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, and without ephod or household idols. And afterwards, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days. Isn't this magnificent? I mean, to me, it's just so incredible what he's written here, because it's not only has been fulfilled to a T, but we can see the very near fulfillment of the rest of it in this chapter 3. And also, there's a pantomime being worked out here in human drama. In other words, look what he says to Hosea. He gets his wife, she's a whore, she's a prostitute, brings her home, she bears him 3 children. But then she gets the itch to leave, saying, what am I doing with this old religious fuddy-duddy man? I want excitement in my life. You know, this is boring. I want some romance, I want some excitement, I want some thrills. So she leaves him and leaves her kids and takes off and starts going after all these other lovers. But look what happens to her. She's out there screwing around with all these other guys, and then she's reduced to desperation, where she's being sold on the marketplace to pay her debts. She's like the prodigal son. Read this, because I think it's very instructive. It says in verse 1, then the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress, which is Gomer, okay? Even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes. In other words, they turn to other gods, okay, and they say they love raisin cakes. These raisin cakes were what they would use in their worship ceremonies. In other words, they loved all of the the things that satisfy their fleshly appetites, you know, with these other, and worshiping these other gods. Okay? And so it says in verse 2, so I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. Now that's very significant, because if you read it back in the book of Deuteronomy, the price of a slave was how much?
30
shekels of silver. Right? So he buys her for 15 shekels of silver plus a homer and a half of barley. Barley was the staple for animals. You would feed your horses barley. It wasn't wheat. Wheat was made primarily for human consumption when they make bread and stuff. Okay, only the poor people use barley to make bread with. Remember when Jesus, when the little boy gave Jesus his lunch and said he had barley loaves? Well, he could tell the kid was poor because instead of wheat loaves, they're barley loaves. Well, here, I think it's very significant. It says a lot here. Not only is this woman reduced to a situation where she's bought back as a slave, but it suggests something about Hosea. It appears that Hosea didn't even have 30 pieces of silver to buy her with. He only had 15 shekels of silver, and he had to make up the rest of it in animal feed to come up with something worth 30 pieces of silver. So in other words, Hosea appears to be a very, you know, modest man with modest means, and it cost him everything he had to buy her back. Isn't that what it cost God? Everything he had to buy his people back from the slavery they're in. It cost him everything he had to buy us back. It cost us every last drop of his blood, didn't it? Mm-hmm. This is what's significant about that, I think. So it says in verse 2, so I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver, suggesting he didn't have 30 pieces, which was the going rate. So instead, he made up the rest of it with what? Animal feed. 15 shekels worth of animal feed to come up with the going price of a slave. So what it suggests to me is that it cost him everything he had to buy this unfaithful woman back. Okay? Isn't that a powerful, powerful illustration of God's love for, you know, his unfaithful people? And then it says here in verse 3, then I said to her, you shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man, so I will be towards you. So, in other words, what happened is Hosea brings her home, and he says, look, we're not going to have relations as man and wife. You need to get your act together. You need to be disciplined. You need to prove your faithfulness to me. So, you know, she's in other words, she's desperate. Okay, she's very, very desperate. She put herself in such a desperate situation. She went off for her fling. She went off for her romance. She went off to have a good time because of her boring religious husband at home. Man, I don't want that old fuddy-duddy. She can have the kids. I'm out of here. But then she makes a complete wreck of her life. And she's reduced to such desperation that she must have felt tremendous gratitude to him to come along and buy her the way he did. Because she knew that this man loved her. And she knew that whoever else would buy her, he would use, abuse, and tattoo her and kick her out on her rear. She knew she was at the end of the line. But he brings her back, you know, puts a roof over her head, gives her protection, gives her security. She knows that she's loved, but she's got to be disciplined. That's what God has done to his people, in a sense. Okay, because look what he says here in that verse 4. For the sons of Israel will remain for many days without a king or prince. That's been fulfilled, right? Mm-hmm. Right down to the T. Now, right now, they don't have a king or a prince, but they do have they have a prince. In other words, they have a president or a prime minister, whatever you want to call them over there in Israel right now. But they, for centuries, for 2,000 years, they didn't have a king or a prince. Anybody, you know, they were just scattered, right? So when it says here, for many days without a king or a prince, without sacrifice or a sacred pillar, that's what's happened. They, you know, for over 2,000 years, they haven't been able to offer sacrifice. Even today, they cannot offer the sacrifice until they get the temple going and everything else, right? Mm-hmm. It says, and without ephod or household idols, without ephod, in other words, without a priest, without the priestly garment, without any of the things that were used in their worship service. And it says, without household idols or teraphim. In other words, they're not even going to have their false gods. They're going to be without everything. Without the true God and without the false God. In other words, just like with Hosea and Gomer. Gomer doesn't have her other lovers. Doesn't have her, Israel doesn't have her household idols, right? But neither does she have Hosea, because he's disciplining her, right? So she's in that situation where there's that, you know, he's disciplining her for her waywardness. You see what I'm saying? See the parallel to me? It's just really profound. You know, when I read this, I say, man, that is something. No man could have made this story up. You know what I'm saying? This you can see the handwriting of God all through this. He says in verse 5, afterwards the sons of Israel return to me and seek the Lord their God and David their king. Who's David their king?
Jesus.
It's Jesus. He comes through the line of David. Mm-hmm. At this point, David has been dead for many, many years. So when it says seek David their king, Jesus Christ is the root of Jesse. He's the root of Jesse. He's a branch of David. Mm-hmm. Right? And they will come trembling to the Lord. In other words, they're going to show reverence and fear and, you know, for God. And they're not going to treat him with contempt the way that they have in the past. And to his goodness in the last days. That's pretty profound, isn't it? But look at the way God plays that whole thing out. He plays it out with the love a man has for an unfaithful woman. Now, Hosea, I'm convinced, loved this woman intensely. He really, really desired her and loved her intensely. And it broke his heart to see this woman's being so unfaithful when all he did was be so good to her. See what I'm saying? I mean, it wasn't as though he just went out there and was obeying God's command but felt nothing for this woman. His heart was probably just hemorrhaging in pain over this woman, because that was a true reflection of God's love for his people and how they were wayward to him. Anybody have anything you want to add or share or